Welcome back to Real Talk Torah, courtesy of the database with Rabbi Yeshua Eisenberg. I'm Rabbi Yeshua Eisenberg, and you just entered the database. And today, for our issue, we are going to talk about the very interesting and disturbing and confusing story of Reuven and Bilhah and his particular sin. And once again, I am joined by my older brother, Rav Daniel Eisenberg. So thank you, Rav Daniel, for joining us, or joining me.
Thank you for having me back.
It's a pleasure.
Especially after all the terrible feedback you got the last time I was on.
Right. So, it's... I'm giving you a chance to redeem yourself, actually. So,
You picked some topic for redemption over here. All right.
Oh, yeah. Let's see what we do with it. We all learn the story as kids, and we learn the story very differently. And this is maybe if you just read the Birchas Yaakov in Parshas Vayechi, so you get this picture of Reuven doing some sin with a bed, and that seems pretty consistent with the pasuk here.
Should we start just from the Chumash?
Yeah, sure. Why not? You know, every now and then the Chumash throws one of these. I like to call it a biblical hit and run. It just smacks us hard, really hard with something, and then it kind of just jumps off of it. So right here, right after Rachel Imenu dies, so the pasuk says, "Vayisa Yisrael," that Yisrael journeyed, Yaakov journeyed, "Vayet Aholo," and he set up his tent. "Mehalo Migdal Eder," says the art school translation. He set up his tent beyond Migdal Eder. "Vayihi Bishkon Yisrael ba'aretz ahi," and it was when Yisrael was dwelling in the land. And if you want to see the actual pasuk, it's in Perek Lamed Hey Pasuk Chav Beis. "Vayelech Reuven," and Reuven went. "Vayishkav es Bilha," I don't even know if I'm allowed to translate it. "Vayishkav es Bilha Pilegesh Aviv Vayishma Yisrael," and then there's a pause in the pasuk. "Vayihiu b'nei Yaakov shneimasar." So that part I'll translate. So Yisrael hears something, and then the pasuk says that the children of Yaakov are 12.
"Vayishkav," and he lay down. "Es" is with. "Bilha" is one of the wives of Yaakov, the Kilegesh of Yaakov, the concubine of Yaakov, the maidservant wife of Yaakov.
Yes, so now the reason, obviously, that I say I don't even know if we're allowed to translate these words is because it's a Beferish Gemara. I know the Gemara in Shabbos, that Gemara is on Daf Nun Hey. Thank you, Zichru. Thank you, Rabbi Goldhar. You can go back and listen to that interview with Rabbi Goldhar on a previous Real Talk Torah. But in the meantime, the Gemara there says that anyone who says that Reuven sinned, or at least sinned in the way that seems to be described in this pasuk, is mistaken. That if you read the text as it is, and you understand what seems to be the pashup shot of this story, that it says, at least that it looks like it says that Reuven lay down and possibly had a relationship with Yaakov's wife or his Pilegesh, Bilhah, so that's a mistake. It's an incorrect read. And I don't remember if it's that Gemara or a different Gemara that says that you're not even allowed to read the Targum for this pasuk out loud when you're in Shul.
Right, so that's not here. I think that's in Chagigah.
Okay.
I believe it's in Chagigah, and over there the Gemara has numerous, it's multiple discussions about what can be translated. Normally, just for background, that used to be that there would be an Aramaic translation, the Targum, done alongside Kriyas of Torah. So they would read up the Baal Kriya, would lay in a pasuk, and then they would translate it into Aramaic, which was the common vernacular of people going to shul. And then there's certain psukim that are not allowed to be translated, and then there are other stories that you might think that we're not allowed to translate them, but indeed we actually are. So that's the Gemara over there.
Right, and I think the Gemara there gives the example of Yehuda and Tamar, who we're going to see that's next week's Parsha. But there's a story there, and there's a union there, And the Gemara says, but that story ultimately presents Yehuda in a positive light, and it's okay to translate that. But you know, this story seems to be different. Well, for one thing, the Yehuda and Tamar story is very elaborate. The Chumash, as I said, this one is like a hit and run. The Chumash just says this pasuk. Right, and I'm not going to say the translation. I'm just going to read the Hebrew. Right, again. That's all it says. That's all the Chumash writes on the topic. So it hits us with this big statement, and then it jumps off it, and we never hear of it again until the Berachas Yaakov, where Yaakov describes how Reuven might have ascended his bed or done something on his bed.
And then later again,
right. So now the question, I guess, there are a lot of questions, but the one big question is obviously what did happen that day, are we not supposed to take the Chumash at its word, right? Because I think one big problem that we find here, and this is a problem that I think we encounter in general, but there's a unique application here. Normally we learn Chumash, right, and you'll see a Pasha Pshat read of the story. And you know, if you're looking for a Pasha Pshat on a story, you could often consult the Ibn Ezra, the Sefarno, or the Rashbam, or the Bechor Shor. You're looking for a Pasha Pshat read. And then sometimes, or often enough, you'll find Rashi quoting a Midrash, which doesn't always seem so consistent with the Pasha Pshat. And you have to try to sometimes maybe read both into the story. We spoke a lot about this 2 weeks ago when we were confronting Yaakov Avinu's quote-unquote lie, right? And we said that, you know, we have this understanding of Yaakov Avinu from our tradition that he's an honest person of truth, and he has no blemishes, he's an ishtam, and the Chumash calls him an ishtam, and yet we have to reconcile that with the complicated stories about Yaakov Avinu, where it seems that he's not being honest. And so there you kind of have to sort of fuse pshat and drash, and that seems to be a normal approach to take. It's not really one or the other. Usually you work with the two of them together. Now, this particular line of drash from the Gemara is obviously very different and very unique in that it's saying that you cannot take the pshat. You know, like in next week's Parsha, we're going to have one of the most important comments of the Rashbam. In Parsha's Vayeshev, when he begins to talk about and expound on the story of Yosef and his brothers, he, you know, maybe we'll talk more about this next week, but one of the important things he says is he quotes the Gemara in Shabbos, I believe it's on Samach Gimel in Shabbos. But he says that the Mikra can never be taken out of its Pasha Pshat. In a Mikra Yosef Mipipshuto. The Chumash always has a Pasha Pshat, and you can never divorce that Pasha Pshat from whatever other reading you're going to have. And then the other major part of that Rashbam is he says the drushas of Chazal are the Iker. So well, I think that's a Rashbam that we have to come back to at some point in our Parsha travels. But in the meantime, here we have a Mikra, which seems to have a Pasha Pshat, and you have this Midrash that says you cannot take this as Pasha Pshat. And this Midrash, it's not just that, like, and you might say, right, there might be more than one opinion, even from Midrash, about what actually happened, right? There are some Midrashim that might imply that the deed happened. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, that is 100% correct. I think that's actually an important overlooked point. The way I hear people sometimes express this discussion is that Chazal say that Reuven did not do what the pasuk seems to say he did, but the term Chazal would seem to say that the conclusive opinion throughout all of the Tanayim and Amorayim is this way, but that's actually not the case. So by the way, just what I was quoting before, the Gemara I think it's Moed Kut, unless it's referenced again. It's in Megillah.
Final okay. Answer.
The Gemara in Megillah is discussing which the Gemara in Megillah is discussing which things can be read and which ones not. it that doesn't necessarily paskin one way or the other.
That's a fair point. Meaning, what I'm understanding is that sometimes we just, you know, there's one, it could be, it might even be a Das Yachid out there, and then it comes up in the Gemara, or it comes in up in the Bereishis Rabbah or something, and then it'll be coined as Chazal. This is Chazal's conclusive opinion.
Especially, I think this is because we are trained to be Talmidim of Rashi, and in many ways, very rightfully so. But what happens, unfortunately, is if somebody does Shnai Mikra with Rashi their whole life, they never take a look at the Ramban or the original sources that Rashi's quoting from, the Midrash Rabbah, Midrash Tanhuma, or the Gemaras. So they'll actually miss the point that there are other opinions. So the Gemara in Megillah that says don't translate this, that's not necessarily saying one way or the other. And the Gemara here, the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Nun Hey Amud Beis, it's Rav Shmuel Bar Nachmani quoting Rav Yonasan, and he says, "Kol Omer, anybody who says this, you know, El Toa." But we have to keep in mind that that's in a series of many examples that, particularly this Amora, quoting this Amora of Yonasan, that he says, David HaMelech didn't sin the way you think he might have sinned, or possibly at all, and the B'nai Shmuel, and the B'nai Eli, and Shlomo HaMelech, and he's presenting all these opinions, but actually the Gemara itself then proceeds to quote a Braisa, which features, I believe, four Tanaic opinions, and of those Tanaic opinions, it's not, a couple of them seem to indicate that he indeed did it. He did have relations with Bilhah, and the other opinions are also not so pushed that, you know, he moved the bed. It might be that he wanted to have relations with Bilhah, and he restrained himself, and he davened that he shouldn't give in to the temptation, which really changes the story completely. So these are a few opinions of Tanayim that say he did it. And there's a similar, this Gemara is similarly quoted in a Bereishis Rabbah and Parshas Vayechi, like a parallel discussion. There are some nuances which are significant, but we should just realize that it's not so simple to say such a thing, right? We know. I think even Rashi might even quote this Midrash in Parshas Vayechi. I mean, maybe it'll be familiar to you that Yaakov calls out. Midrashically calls out Reuven for what he did, and he said, right, Rachis Oni, and he says, you are the first drop of Zera that came out of me when I was 84 years old, and you did this sin, right? Does that sound clear to you? Perhaps, I know it's Rachis Rabbah, it could be Rashi quotes that in Chumash, but
by Rachis Oni, they do quote that particular piece, that he was the first drop of Zera.
Right, so according to that, Yaakov saying, Reuven, you know, you did this sin. If he just moved the bed, it has nothing to do with the drop of Zera. So, to say that Chazal, you know, completely, unanimously, very definitively say that Reuven didn't do anything wrong, I don't think that's true. I think we should show proper respect and do our utmost to understand that Shita. But just to have this a little bit of an expanded perspective on Chazal's feelings about this story.
So I want to agree, and I also want to possibly counter, because I do think that you make a fair point that even within the scope of Chazal, within the scope of Drash, you have variants of opinions. But I would just point out that, just like you mentioned earlier about being a Talmud of Rashi, so it's very telling when this is the Mesorah that Rashi wants you to take away. And I would add that it's not just Rashi. Right, so if you look just what, you know, I surveyed some of the Mefarshim. So if you look at Rashi, Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel, Ramban, even Rambam, I think. I don't remember where I have it, but I have a source somewhere. And so you have many Mefarshim who are taking the Mikra out of Pshuto. And they are suggesting, like that, if you want to call it a Das Yachid, that they're saying that the story is not meant to be understood as Pshat. And like you have sources that do say read it Kipshuto. The Bechor Shor says read it Kipshuto. The Radak, he quotes both. He says, here's how you might read a Kipshuto. And then the Radak, who many, I would say more often than not, is a Pashtun, and he says, but here's the drasha from Chazal. I don't remember his exact lashon, but he says something to that effect. Da'as Mikra, who often quotes like a variety of opinions, and he will never be afraid of Pashat Pshat. So he compares it to Avshalom sleeping with the Pelagesh of David HaMelech, meaning it's an act of open rebellion. But you have Mefarshim, you know, even Pashtunim, who are, you know, who are kind of just pushing this Mesorah. And even like Rav Hirsch says, you have a lot of Mefarshim that are working really hard to read this statement from Chazal into the Pasuk. So for example, Rav Hirsch, who often is usually a Pashtun who's not, you know, so afraid to say what he thinks is Pashat Pshat, he says maybe it means that Reuven slept in her bed, but didn't actually sleep with her. And there's actually a shiur from Rabbi Daniel Gladstein on Torah Anytime. He goes through a bunch of different opinions. He quotes Rabbeinu Ephraim and Atur and others who say Vayelech Reuven means that Reuven actually ran away and he caused a ruckus, like, you know, a search party. And he Vayelech Reuven, Reuven traveled away, he walked away, and then Yaakov, on the night that he was going to be with Bilhah, so Yaakov had to go out and look for him. The Chida, the Chidushi HaGirshuni, B'Shem the Ramah, and the Gra, all three of them, they say that, no, Vayelech Reuven means Reuven walked by. He walked by, you know, when Yaakov and Bilhah would have been together, and they hear the pitter-pattering of Reuven walking by, and so, you know, they separated. And all of these different variations are seems like they're bending over backwards, working overtime to make sure that you can't possibly read that into the pasuk. I think there's this. I'll just say that I just want to add. Rabbi Gladstein added this point. I think it was. I don't remember if the story was. I think the story was B'Shem the Ramah, that the Ramah offered this opinion, and then Reuven came to him in a dream and gave him a kiss on the head. So, you know, you tell me if Reuven comes to you tonight after, you know, we're done talking about this. But whatever you want to make of that story, we see these Mefarshim working overtime to uphold this drasha.
So I think what the next step for us, unless you want to take a different direction, would be to explain the motivation of that understanding. But
right, and that we didn't even get to, and I think that's important background, right? So
yeah, I can't ignore Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania.
And I think we would have to look at each individual, you know, if we were doing the Gemara inside, you know, we would look at each opinion and see exactly what they say on the matter. Because we can all possibly agree that Reuven did the wrong thing, and we can have a discussion about what was the thing that he did.
Yeah, right. Especially when the basis, at least in the Gemara, in the Midrash, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai has a the Gemara quotes it too actually, but has like a proof, which is an interesting proof, and I think the Midrash has a response, but over here the Gemara, everyone's raya is based on how to interpret the Rashi Tevos of Pachas. What does Pachas Kamayim, what does Pachas stand for? And then Rabbi Elazar Amudai turns backwards and does it.
Right.
Says what it stands for, like a Zion Chespeh. So, I mean, obviously, you know, this discussion, the Gemara would deserve its own shear just to look at all these opinions and try to figure out what they're really saying, where it's coming from. But with that background, that there are two main stories here, right? The one which would seem to be explicit in the text, which is that Reuven had relations with Bilhah, and then the version that Chazal that the alternative that Chazal suggests.
Okay.
Meaning,
and
not,
with this alternative,
not all Chazal suggests this alternative. But if there's one alternative that you want to find in Chazal, it's not like the reverse you quoted exactly. It's not like all the others you quoted. Is that he moved around the beds.
Right. And so this particular opinion, so let's just get the background. Most of our listeners, I assume, are familiar, but just, you know, in case there's a little lack of clarity. So Rachel Aminu died. She's the main wife. She's the Akeres HaBayis of Yaakov Avinu. So Yaakov Avinu has to move his bed, and because there's no more Rachel Aminu's tent. So we might have thought that the next logical place for Yaakov's bed would have been in Leah's tent. She would have been the next main wife, and Reuven, in fact, had this contention that Yaakov should have moved his bed into Leah's tent. But Yaakov moves it into Bilhah's tent. Bilhah was the handmaiden of Rachel, and that's where Yaakov moves his tent. And Reuven, according to this opinion in Chazal, he moves Yaakov's bed out of the tent. Presumably, he moves it out of Bill's tent, and I guess he moves it back into Leah's tent, or whatever it is. But he somehow keeps Yaakov from being with Bilhah, and a lot of the Mefarshim point out that the Gemara, the fact that the Chumash goes out of its way to tell us that the children of Yaakov Avinu were 12, this shows you that Reuven wasn't entirely demoted from the family, wasn't kicked out, he wasn't disowned. In fact, he was still, in certain respects, by title at least, he was the Bechor. And again, just so we understand, the nature of this particular Midrash is unlike other Midrashim, which says, oh, here's the Pashup Shot, but here's the Midrash, that you should know, you know, in some other world, this is what was also going on at the same time simultaneously. That's not what this particular Midrash is saying. This particular statement is saying what you are reading, you know, don't believe in your lying eyes, you know, so to speak. That's not true. That's not how to read it. In fact, you're not even allowed to read the Targum on it, maybe for this reason, because this is not true. But what did happen is not that Reuven lay down with Bilhah, but he actually just moved to bed. And again, this is a very unique approach, because it's telling you not to take at its word what the Chumash says there, which makes this story particularly challenging. It says this sentence and nothing else, and which is also perhaps very telling. You know, you have a story again like Yehuda and Tamar, where the Chumash is very elaborate about what happens. Here, we don't really have a narrative, we barely have any background, and without this Midrash, you might not have a clue what's flying here.
Right.
But this is what the Chumash gives us.
So now it's, and of course, if you're going to take the approach that it is not to be taken literally, then you have to understand why it's written the way it's written. And typically the answer will be something along the lines of, it's because for someone like Reuven at his level to interfere in the marital life of Yaakov the way he did, so it's considered for him as if he did it, but of course he didn't actually, wasn't so base and low to do such a horrible atrocity like this. Again, so we're going to have to try
And the Gemara has similar statements about Chofni and Pinchas and Sefer Shmuel, which we don't need to get into now, but just to know that there are similar drushos out there.
Right. That interfering in a husband and wife being together is tantamount to adultery in some sense for people on a higher level. So let's try to figure out what this what the motivation.
One second, I think we lost you. Okay, we lost you at motivation.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to not motivate you.
I know what the word motivation means, but your voice went out.
Yeah. So we have to figure out the motivation for those who take this approach, and it could be that the answer is just simply Masorah, that you know, they have a tradition, you know, Reb Shmuel Bar Nachmani had a tradition that he got from Reb Yonasan, who got from, you know, could be all the way from Moshe Rabbeinu, that Reuven didn't do it.
For all we know.
And therefore we have to bend over backwards and try to figure out how to make the text work with this tradition. But it could be there's more to that, right? And maybe we'll speak about the Trump thing in a moment. But it could be that just looking at the objective text, you have to look at the clues, you have to look at the evidence around, and perhaps understand that it's actually not, it doesn't fit so much better to say that Reuven actually did it. So one thing that you pointed out, which the Gemara points out, which is that that it says right afterwards that like it, in the same pasuk, in the same breath, that the sons of Yaakov were 12, seemingly including Reuven.
By the way, some say that means they were 12 and not more than that, because that was Yaakov's possible last chance.
Correct. So that would answer the response that, you know, he did something wrong here. So it's true that you can debate that.
By the way, even if you say Reuven didn't do the deed, this just means that Yaakov was parish from, you know, he was parish from Bilhah, he separated from her, and just didn't have, you know, another union. Meaning, you don't have to say that Reuven did anything with Bilhah for this to have happened, or you could say he did. Now, there's obviously...
Well, I mean, it seems to be that the mention of 12 sons is somehow related to something that happened with Reuven and Bilhah, and it's something that Cleves have just figured out on its own. The sons were 12, so it seems to be intentional. So either it is certainly saying he did it, or certainly saying he did not. But I don't think it's...
Right, but I'm saying, even if you take the opinion that he did not, the fact that Yaakov's children are 12 can still be a disparaging statement criticizing Reuven, who might not have done the deed, but he did interfere with the marital life of his father.
And the Gemara mentions another piece which the Midrash refutes, but it's the point that how could it possibly be that Reuven, that Shevet Reuven would be on Har Eval, and make the curse against adultery with the father's wife if Reuven actually did it. It that's the debatable point. That's
right.
Not really evidence from the text. That's just
right.
Like a ha'ara.
Right, that's a fair point.
Opinion. But I think some of the evidence from the text is a couple. Really, the other mentions of this story, because as you said, it looks like it's a hit and run, but the truth is, it's not. The story is repeated twice, to my knowledge, in Tanakh.
Okay.
We mentioned it a couple of times. First of all, on Yaakov's deathbed, when Yaakov is giving the Birchas Yaakov to his children. So the fact that Yaakov says, he gives him a bracha, and even though there's certain things that, you know, might be more of like a curse, but for rebuke to Reuven, it's rather vague. It doesn't mention Bilhah. It doesn't say anything about adultery or incest. He's a little bit impetuous. And he condemned the lack of
right.
towards his father's marital.
You don't call an incestuous adulterer impulsive. You call him other things.
Right. And ascending the couch. Meaning, even if he's talking in the Lashon Nakiya, but like, this is your time to give rebuke. This is it. If indeed the sin was sexual in nature and even adultery and incest, so one would expect Yaakov to use much harsher terms than merely, you know, impetuous and disrespectful to his father. Now, granted, it's not, you know, the wonderful brachos that Yehuda or Yosef got, but you would expect a much harsher response for him to do something so diabolical and atrocious as the text seems to say that he did, for him to say, oh, you're part of the family, come over here for your bracha. And by the way, I really need to talk to you about that thing you did. It wasn't so nice. Like, you would expect so much more.
Right.
And that alone is reason to believe that Reuven is you know, not he didn't do what the pasuk seems to say, that kol omer Reuven tara Reuven kata ino elatoa, that you're making a mistake. But I think also another point is that in Dvarayom as well, when it's quoted,
Dvarayom, it's in Perek Hay. It's the first pasuk in Perek Hay. Perek Hay pasuk Aleph.
Okay, right, so it says over there that Ezra is basically explaining why Reuven lost the Bechorah and the Malchus to Yosef, and why he lost the Bechorah to Yosef, the Malchus to Yehuda. And over there, Ezra Divrei uses a very clean and vague expression of Reuven having profaned Yaakov's couch.
Right, so, he defiled his father's couch, right? That's very vague.
Right. So, like, one would think that Divya-Yam's intent is, right, it's trying to, like, write the and speak the praises of a malchus-based oven and justify the malchus being stripped away from Reuven to Yehuda, to justify it. So you would think that the author would describe Reuven's hate in full detail. But Divya-Yam also keeps it very, very clean. And, again, of course, you know, about anybody who's listening who's learning Pesachim, of course we know the importance of Lashon Nekiya. Of course that's true. But the Torah can be explicit when it wants to be explicit. And there are certain places that Yaakov should have perhaps been explicit, the very young could have been explicit, but it's not. And these pieces of evidence, in addition to the fact that the Torah immediately mentions that there are 12 of them, these might point to the fact that Reuven didn't actually do what the text did. So before you get to Masora, before you get to, you know, any tradition and discussion of the Torah, which I don't even know if I have time for, but the text itself of Tanakh as an entirety, Sefer Bereishis as an entirety, and then Tanakh, when you extend it all the way from the first Sefer to the last Sefer of Tanakh, it's hard to see this. Especially, I mean, Reuven's name on the Choshen, you know.
Right. I mean, Yosef, just bear in mind, Yosef, according to Midrash, Yosef almost got his name taken off the Choshen.
Right.
When I guess that would have been Eshes Isha, you know, at worst, which is not really, it's not a good thing. But this is like Eshes of, which is even like we might say that's worse than just regular Eshes Ish.
It certainly is.
So. That's a good point.
So it's hard to understand the storyline of the Torah and why things are written if Reuven really did such a thing. Now, again, there are some Tanaim who do want to take it at face value, but it's so reasonable to understand opinions that cannot, just for the sake of Pshat in the text of the Chumash.
Sure.
Why they can't accept it as at face value,
right? And I think that's an important point. Meaning, we're trying to use context, and I think, you know, even though, you know, and again, we keep on coming back to this term that I coined for this particular kind of thing, a biblical hit and run. It's the fact that the Chumash, although we would say the Chumash uses its words sparingly and in general tries not to be so elaborate, but when it comes to narratives, you know, usually the, you know, especially major narratives, you know, narratives where if you're going to even touch that topic, we're assuming that there's going to be some kind of elaboration. The fact that it doesn't elaborate here says something about how the Chumash wants you to perceive this. It's almost like this story is a very blurry story. It's a blurry story in its own right. What actually happened? You know, one approach that I've had, and I, you know, I wrote a long essay on this topic, and I usually try not to suggest a novel interpretation unless I find it to be very consistent with Masora, and this one I think is. But it's the fact that if you look at the context, most of the Yaakov Avinu narratives, we have his regular name Yaakov Avinu, even after Hashem started calling him Yisrael. So in the story of, let's say, Shechem and Dina and Shimon and Levi, so there he's called Yaakov. Throughout the rest of the Torah, he's mainly called Yaakov. There are exceptional cases where he's called Yisrael. This is one of those exceptional cases. And it's very interesting. If you look at the context, it says, Vayisa Yisrael, right? So this is after Rachel dies, right? So the very previous pasuk from there says, Vayatsev Yaakov Matseva. Yaakov makes a Matseva for Rachel. Next pasuk, Yisrael travels. Then it says, Vayhi Bishkon Yisrael. It's when Yisrael was dwelling. Right? Then it says that again, Vayelech Reuven, and then it describes Reuven's deed. Vayishma Yisrael. And Yisrael hears. In the same pasuk, Vayu bnei Yaakov Shneimasar. And the children, now we're finally back to Yaakov, and then from, I think, till the rest of the parsha, he's Yaakov again. So in this little narrative, this tiny little narrative, this blurry narrative, he's called Yisrael. And I think this possibly goes back to what you were saying before, and you might, and some people might think that this is an apologetic kind of an answer. That why would you malign Reuven like that, and say that Reuven did this terrible, terrible deed when he really didn't? It's like the Chumash is being motzi shem ra on Reuven. It seems, if we are to accept that Reuven didn't do this, But the approach again is keilu, right? And is that fair? We take this as if approach that it's as if Reuven, you know, he committed adultery by interfering in the marital affairs of his father. But again, he didn't do it. And why would you say he did? But if we look at the difference between Yisrael and Yaakov, so Yisrael always, and I didn't come up with this. I think there's a Netziv who says this. I think there are multiple sources that say that Yisrael always refers to the spiritual legacy and identity of Yaakov Avinu, the larger picture Yaakov Avinu. And Yaakov Avinu, whenever it says Yaakov, it's talking about the physical human being Yaakov. You know, from here on in. So it could be, so like, right. So the this predates me, but if we run with that, what we have is from in terms of a historical account, we barely have that in these couple of psukim. We barely have enough to call it a story. We don't have the report like we have for other narratives. What we do have is in the realm of Yisrael, something happened. In the spiritual realm of Yisrael, something was disturbed. And then, before the story is over, Yaakov, as opposed to Yisrael, Yaakov's children are 12. The physical bodies of Yaakov's children, the physical body of Yaakov, you know, is a regular story. And I think that what we can learn from this is that, you know, whenever you do any mundane action, whatever that might be, there's always the physical, you know, impression of what you did, whatever actual practical ramifications there were, and then there are spiritual ramifications. And again, I don't think this is an apologetic reading. Now, this might be the pashut pshat almost, if I can use those words, of this very blurry and ready complicated narrative, which is barely a narrative if we can call it one. So maybe in the world of Yisrael, you know, what Reuven did is considered as if. And in the world of, you know, in the real world that we live in, where we don't always see the spiritual actions, so say Chazal, or say at least that one opinion in Chazal, you can't read the story as it is. And maybe because the story is really not, it's not legible as it is. Now, you said you had had an approach pertaining to the Trup, that maybe the Trup intimates that a certain degree of innocence for Reuven in this story.
Yeah, so there's a couple of sets of trup over here, in most Chumashim, at least the way the Ashkenazim do it. I'm not so familiar with the way it's done for Sardar. It could be that some actually read both sets, but there are two sets of trup on these sukkim. And the way Ashkenazim read it, there's one that Ashkenazim would read while, like, you know, learning on their own, doing Shnaya Mikra, something like that, and there's another set of trup that would be used in shul.
Mm-hmm. Similar, now, I guess, to Tam Elyon Tam Tachton on the Aseres Adibros.
Yes, very, very similar. So, I mean, except that in many Chumashim, they're written very confusingly, mm-hmm. because you'll see on each word two sets of trup, and it'll sound like a train wreck if you try to read it like that. But if you have a good tikkun, we'll separate them properly, like the Aseres Adibros are in most of the question. So if you take a look at them, it just, you know, there's it doesn't seem to have an explanation. I'll even lean the psukim. There are a few differences, like four noticeable differences. So it's Bishkon Yisrael Baratzaki Vayelech Ruve.
Okay.
So
that's what I have in the Chumash that I'm looking at right now.
What?
Yeah, that's what I have in the Chumash that I'm looking at right now.
Okay. And then there's another one that Vayibishkon Yisrael Ba'aretzahi is the same, and Vayelech, instead of Vayelech Ruvein, it's Vayelech Ruvein.
Okay.
Instead of Vayishkav, it's Vayishkav, Espelav Yilagashaviv, Vayishma Yisrael. And there's a sof pasuk there.
Interesting.
And then by you, b'nei Yaakov, shnei masar, and the 12 sons of Yaakov were 12. So these are two versions, two ways to read it. The most noticeable differences are the ones that I think I called out, is that one of them is there's a revi'i on Reuven, as opposed to Reuven. And then in the other version, it's Vayishkav, as opposed to Vayishkav.
So instead of a pashto, it's a kef gadol.
Yes, a gadol and a pashta, And then I just don't want to confuse anybody too much who doesn't lean too often. Those are two differences. And another major difference is that there's a sof pasuk, meaning an early period in the phrase, according to one. Right. In the Torah, there's a space here after Vayishma Yisrael and Yisrael heard. He heard about what happened. And then it says, and the sons of Yaakov were 12. Now, in one version, we read it as like a comma, Vayishma Yisrael, Vayu b'nei Yaakov shnei masar. And in another version, it's Vayishma Yisrael. Period. But you b'nei Yaakov shnei masar. So the way I understood with noting those three differences. So this is the way I've understood it, is that so the first version where there's Revi on Reuven, and this is the one that you read in Shul. Mm-hmm. So in Shul, what do you read? You read Reuven by Yishkav. Mm-hmm. And then, which is Reuven, where the Revi is on Reuven, so there's like a descent and an emphasis on Reuven. Revi is like a pronounced cantillation piece, right? So the emphasis is on Reuven, and it's Revi, which is like a descent, and then Vayishkav, which means he lay. That is not as noticeable. It doesn't make as big an impact. Meaning that the way to read it is it's de-emphasizing the action of him laying.
But the emphasis is on Reuven. We're looking at you, Reuven. You did something.
And perhaps his descent, Reuven.
Right.
Right. Oh, and what that would be demonstrating is that it's saying
on Reuven's level.
Sorry.
Almost like on Reuven's level. Emphasis on Reuven.
Yeah, for Reuven, let's focus not on the Vayishkav, but on the Reuven. And this, meaning this is a much more positive reflection. This is that he didn't really do it. It's just on his level. It's as if he did. And in this version as well, it's not a sof pasuk. It's Vayishma Yisrael. And then the end of the pasuk, Vayu v'nei Yaakov shnei masar, which would confirm that proof from the Gemara that this the one we read in public is that version. It's the version of the emphasis is on Reuven. Vayishkav is minimal. And you can't read the pasuk without concluding Vayu b'nei Yaakov shnei masar. However, in the other version of the one that you read when you're reading by yourself, so it's Vayelech Reuven, no special emphasis on Reuven, Vayishkav zakev gadol, which sometimes points out something very interesting or a contrast or something strange, right? So there's more of an emphasis, which is, what did Reuven do? Vayishkav, can you believe it? Right? Can you believe what he did? He lay.
Right.
He can't even say it. Vayishma Yisrael, and the pasuk ends, and Yisrael heard.
Right.
And then the next pasuk, not related, Vayu b'nei Yaakov shnei masar. So.
One second, we lost you again. And yeah, okay, I think we got you. You back?
Okay, so Vayu v'nei Yaakov shnei masar. So it's like an unrelated pasuk. It's not, it doesn't have to do with the story. So what we have here, based on these two sets of trump, we have two ways to read the pasuk. One, the one we read in public in shul, sounds like, the one we read privately on our own, sounds like
almost like pasuk shot.
Text. Mm-hmm. And the one that we read, in shul is out loud during Kriyas HaTorah seems to be reflecting more of this opinion of the Gemara that he didn't actually do it. It's just not on his level. Where do these sets of trup come from? In general, we assume that the trup are going way back. Right? The Gemara in Gil and other places and indicates that could be Halacha Moshe Sinai, these trup that we got them in Har Sinai. So these are definitely, the trup are Masoretic, so we have them for a long time.
Right.
These two sets of trup are also from there. So right here we have two different ways to read it. Now, what might that indicate? So I guess there are two different ways to understand the two sets of trup. Could be that
Reuven did it.
However, we don't want to be mavazin, we don't want to embarrass him in public. So when we do the public Kriyas HaTorah and people are going to misunderstand it and they're not going to realize that he did Shuvah Shlema So, you know, we're going to read it in a more flattering way. You could understand it like that, or you could possibly understand the reverse, that no, he didn't do it. He certainly didn't do it. And when we're talking in the general public, and we're not being behind and trying to learn from all the details, so we're not going to make him look worse than he really was. However, when you're learning on your own, you're trying to understand the story on a deeper level, so you understand what the Torah compares it to. So it could be that that would also be there. So these two different sets of Trump reflect these two main ways to read this.
I have to say that's fascinating, and so thank you for sharing that with all of us. I think there's so much more that can be and really should be said, and I think you and I have to meet again for another conversation just to talk more about Pshat, Drash, maybe the whole gamut of Pardes, and just to understand how to learn some of these things together. I think this is definitely an exceptional case, and therefore an exceptional conversation. So thank you for joining us once again. And looking forward to having you for a future conversation on similar topics, trying to understand what's happening in the Chumash. Yeah. Again, it was a pleasure. In the meantime, keep it real, keep talking, and most importantly, keep the Torah. Thanks for joining us here at the database.